Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you. Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
You're listening to Justice, a podcast exploring all areas of the justice system, with me, prison philanthropist and founder of One Small Thing, Edwina Grosvenor. This week I speak to Natasha Finlayson, Chief Executive of Working Chance. Working Chance is the UK's only employment charity solely for women with convictions. In this episode, Natasha explains the support they provide to women and the impressive outcomes they achieve, including 90% of women using their employment service securing a job.
I'm Natasha Finlayson, and I'm Chief Executive of Working Chance, which is an employment charity for women with convictions.
Why was Working Chance set up? What's the need for it in our country?
So Working Chance was set up in 2009 by my predecessor, Jocelyn Hillman, because she spent a lot of time visiting in Holloway Prison and started to understand the sort of the untapped pool of talent, as it were, of women in prison and the lack of opportunities for them when they came out and the extent of employer prejudice and more broadly societal prejudice against them that was really holding them back. And she realised that there was a space for, I guess, a recruitment consultancy, really a very niche recruitment consultancy that would be there to support these women into jobs and to persuade employers of their talents. So that's kind of how we were set up. I think we're quite different today. We certainly don't think of ourselves as a recruitment consultancy. We're a charity and have a slightly different perspective, but we're still fundamentally doing the same thing, supporting women with convictions with their employability and ultimately to get a job and a sustainable, meaningful job, ideally.
And how have you found people's attitudes? How have they changed, if at all, since sort of 2009? Do you think people are getting slightly more open-minded about it? Do you think it's getting worse? What are you seeing on the front line?
In terms of employer attitudes, I think there are shifts, but not that much, actually, because if you look at there was sort of some market research done by an organisation called Working Links back in 2010. And then there was a big piece of YouGov research commissioned by the DWP in 2016. So our market research that we've just done enables us to track back against those other two surveys and see how much things have changed. And they've changed far less, I think, than we were actually hoping. So a quarter of all the employers that we spoke to said that they would be definitely concerned about the idea of employing anybody with a conviction. And another 35% said they'd probably be concerned. So that actually means that 60%, you know, if we extrapolate out of our very large sample, 60% of employers are saying that they'd have quite a significant worry or concern about employing someone with a conviction. And that's more that we asked them about other groups as well. So, for example, people with harmful substance use, people who are homeless, people with severe mental health, long-term unemployed, and they were less concerned about all of those groups, which really does tell us, I think, we've still got quite a long way to go in terms of educating employers who are, of course, you know, just kind of reflective of wider society. So I guess helping people outside the criminal justice sector to understand that these are people, first and foremost, to see the person, not the offence, to understand that risk is really that is really a misconception.
Was your research able to extrapolate sort of out whether employers actually said, well, it depends what the offence was, because clearly it could be anything from murder to a driving offence, right?
Yeah. In fact, we did absolutely have a list of offences which started with driving offence, and the bottom one was murder, in terms of how people listed how much that would affect them. But the variations there were not as much as you would think. So still a reasonable proportion of people who wouldn't employ anybody with a driving offence, you know, and regardless of when the driving offence was or the circumstances. So again, you know, no, I'm sorry, I think the prejudices really are quite deep-seated, or you know, if we're going to be kind about it, let's say lack of awareness, lack of understanding of the risk that people with a conviction present. And as you say, that just, you know, the kind of the variety of offences and when it was committed, and, you know, kind of mitigating factors, or, you know, kind of contextual factors. You know, there isn't that nuance, really, I think, in employer attitudes.
And are you talking about women who have served a prison sentence, or is this women who might have served a community sentence or just had a fine?
So the research is about people with convictions, so both men and women, and we didn't specify kind of when the conviction would be. And, you know, and as I say, we use the language ex-offender, because that then helps us to kind of track back against previous surveys that use the same terminology.
Okay, but it wasn't particularly people who'd come out of prison.
No, and I think just as an illustration of that, the sort of the lack of awareness and understanding and nuance in these sort of judgments and prejudices, 30% of employers said that they would automatically exclude from any consideration in a recruitment process anybody with an unspent conviction. So, you know, I think, again, it just really points to the fact that we've all just got to do so much more in terms of educating the public. I mean, that's very much part of Working Chances' mission, explicitly. We do believe that's a really important part of our job, to help people to understand, you know, I mean, particularly with women, the factors that so often underlie their offending, and, you know, the kind of the pathways that they've taken into criminalisation. But also then just for employers particularly, to understand the level of risk, which really is, there's no evidence to show that it's any more risky to employ someone with a conviction than someone who doesn't have a conviction.
Exactly. And I talk about this all the time. You know, even if someone has committed a violent act, it doesn't make them a risk. You know, those two things need to be separated out, and a certain level of intelligence and analysis needs to go into making a judgment. But of course, it's much easier, I guess, from someone in an organisation to say, right, we're going to have a blanket ban on X, Y and Z. But I remember from my days with the Clink restaurant chain and getting men and women out into the workplace, our chief executive at the time would say, well, look, if you want to know how this person's behaved over the last 5 years, I can give you so much information on this person, or you can recruit someone off the street that could tell you anything, and you have no control or any way of working out whether they're telling the truth or not. So that was quite an interesting way that our chief executive sort of cut through. You could see people going, oh, I get so much more information about this person.
Exactly. You know, most employers really don't know who they've kind of got working there. But as you say, you do know if someone's disclosed a conviction. I mean, I get, you know, some of the sort of things that were being thrown up in the research, that, you know, because we're trying to kind of just tease under the surface and kind of get into what actually are the fears, what are the beliefs, you know, and they were throwing up sort of things like that. They thought the person would be unreliable. 66% of employers said they thought someone with a conviction would be unreliable. They might be out of touch with the workplace. They might have problematic social skills. 61% said they might pose a risk to other employees.
I think touching on that point, it's about what we hold in mind when the word ex-offender is vocalised. And depending maybe on what type of media you consume, some people will think, oh, well, I'm very open-minded and it could mean anything from, you know, wrong place, wrong time, driving offence, or it could, you know, it could go all the way to the extremes of paedophilia, murder, you know. But then some people will just think, well, any ex-offender is obviously violent and a risk, and that is that, and cannot see anything beyond that viewpoint.
I think that the sort of the punitive approach to criminal justice rather than rehabilitative goes deeper than sometimes we in the sector think. You know, I'm like most people in charities, I probably live in a bit of a liberal bubble echo chamber kind of thing. And talking to people about these issues just never, it's always a reminder that most people don't see it that way, don't really think about rehabilitation. I mean, even when I took this role up 3.5 years ago, some good friends said, you know, jokingly said, oh, well, you'll have to watch where you leave your handbag then, won't you? You know, which is very awkward because I thought, don't laugh, you know, I mean, don't collude with it. That's not a good thing to say. But then at a dinner party with good friends, you know, how are you going to respond? But, you know, I mean, you know, but I don't want to sort of come across as holier than thou and sort of preachy. But, you know, and before I took this role up, I probably to some extent had some of those attitudes. I've spent most of my career working with children who've experienced abuse. So as far as people whose offence was child abuse, I probably had far more simplistic kind of punitive view, a sort of, you know, not really focused on rehabilitation or understanding where that kind of offending comes from. But now I see things differently, you know, and I do. Yeah. Rehabilitation is so incredibly important, isn't it?
Yeah, it's in all of our interests, including the people who need to be rehabilitated. It's a sort of win-win thing, isn't it? And it's really important that we do it and do it correctly. I was going to ask you on the sort of, I guess, the education of employers, how is that best done? Because that's quite tricky, isn't it? Is it just down to the person who runs that organisation to kind of broaden their mind and try and go on an educational journey themselves and thinking about how they want their organisation to be? And of course, the person in the organisation that always springs to mind when we're talking about things like this is James Timpson, who runs and is the CEO of the Timpson chain of shops. And he's, of course, a great advocate in this space. Does everyone have to be a James Timpson to sort of...
I mean, of course, yeah, that Timpson's is the example to spring, that springs to mind, and kind of Greggs and Halfords, and there are some kind of real sort of well-known brands like that where if you were to survey the public, you know, you might even get a good response and people saying, oh, yeah, they employ people who've been in prison. It's good they do that, you know. But I think sort of to your point about that education piece, it's probably not just the people who run the company. I think it's good if it includes the people who run the company and sort of HR directors in large organisations, but it has to be a whole organisation thing, because sometimes when we've placed women into roles with companies, occasionally there'll be some sort of little stumbling blocks once they're in post, and that comes down to their immediate line manager and their colleagues alongside them. Maybe they find out something about the offending that wasn't known to them, perhaps that wasn't all shared with the line manager. Perhaps the line manager is being overly solicitous and kind of treating them unequally in a really well-intentioned way and constantly asking them how they are and this sort of thing. You know, I've heard of quite a few examples of where a manager has sat down with the rest of the team and the person and shared the person's conviction with them in a kind of well-intentioned way, wanting to be really open and transparent so there's no gossip and no Googling and, you know, this person did this, would you like to say a bit about it to the person with warning? So that there's a lot of kind of compelling arguments as to why it should be a whole company thing that everybody understands and everybody buys into that doesn't feel like it's imposed on the organisation from above, because everyone's got to understand where it's coming from and how they should treat colleagues with convictions if they know that they have colleagues with convictions. And the answer to that is, of course, no differently from how you treat everyone else in the vast majority of cases, unless there is a particular support need that their line manager should be aware of. So when we talk to employers, Edwina, we're very mindful about what their motivation is. So we don't just accept any employer who rings up, and goodness me, there's a lot of them ringing up over the last few months with the labour shortages. We don't have to approach any companies. They are all coming to us all around the country. I mean, it's so different to how it would have been pre-Brexit and pre-pandemic before the labour shortages. But as I say, we don't take all of them. We go through quite a gentle but firm process of asking certain questions and trying to explore the motivation, and then just a few kind of sort of ethical considerations, and do they have, you know, diversity and inclusion policies and pay fairly and all that sort of thing.
So with your cohort of women, how many would you say come out of prison or have come out of prison?
So with the women that we work with at Working Chance, actually less than half have served custodial sentences. And for those who have been in prison, it's not normally straight away afterwards because, you know, I mean, you know this very well, but life is so incredibly complicated for women when they have left prison, in many ways differently, I think, from men. So if they have children, who's been looking after the children? Have they gone into care? Are they being looked after by a family member who perhaps doesn't want to hand them back? You know, kind of around 60% of women leaving prison don't have safe and secure accommodation to go to, you know, kind of debt, all of these different things that they're struggling with. So getting a job, while that would, you know, arguably be helpful, probably isn't the first thing on their minds. You know, they're not really in a sort of a mental place where they can be job hunting and kind of going to interviews. So for women who've come out of prison, it's often some months or even some years later that they come to us. And there'll be some women whose conviction was many, many years ago in their past, but is still holding them back in terms of getting or sustaining jobs or moving on in their career. It could be that it's something that comes up in enhanced disclosures, so it's a barrier in that way, and they have to disclose every time they apply for a new job, and they dread doing that, and they've probably had awful experiences of doing it. Or it could also be that it's still, you know, perhaps the circumstances that led to the offence and then the experience of being in the criminal justice system are still affecting the woman and her, you know, her view of herself and her confidence and self-worth and so on. And that's absolutely something that we're really happy to help those women with as well.
I was going to ask whether you knew how many people, I saw a stat recently, but I'm not sure if I'm going to get it correct, but how many people in the population actually have a conviction, whether it's serious or very, very minor, because often they are very, very minor, aren't they? And they might have happened to someone when they were 18 years old, yet you have a 45-year-old man who is still being held back from something stupid that they did when they were 18, where no one particularly got hurt and it wasn't a major incident. And I did see a stat somewhere that I think it was 1 in 6 people in the population have a conviction.
I think it's 11 million, so I can't quite do the maths, but I'm sure that sounds about right, 1 in 6. It really, really, really is, isn't it? And I think and telling people that just gets across to them that, you know, this is not a kind of tiny minority of criminally minded people who are really different from the rest of us. You know, that it kind of could happen to any of us. And I'm sure that I and most of the people I know have broken the law at some point in their lives in some way, whether they knew it or not.
Absolutely. And in a time, as you rightly said, in the sort of labour shortages that we're seeing, and then if you couple that with the amount of people who apparently have a conviction, you know, that's kind of disastrous. So surely people are going to have to start moving in a slightly more open-minded way in order to get the people into the jobs that we need to.
Absolutely. And they are. And that's why those, you know, that we've had this exponential increase in employers approaching us. And while I most definitely don't want to look a gift horse in the mouth, I'd like to be more hopeful that this is a sustainable change in attitude, let's put it that way. So, you know, I don't want it to be something that's purely expedient where, you know, let's characterise this really negatively, for example. It could be that the mindset, consciously or not, of employers is, oh my goodness me, we have got a desperate shortage, we can't go through the normal recruitment channels, let's lower the barriers, let's lower the standards, we will take anybody. So we throw out our usual kind of, you know, sort of policies that might exclude certain groups. So that's a really negative characterisation of it. I guess the best characterisation is that they are becoming more open-minded, and by the very fact of engaging with organisations like Working Chance and others like us, means that they are open to those discussions. And you get a foot in the door then, don't you? Then you can start to have those conversations about, you know, could we talk to you a little bit about the sorts of backgrounds that women might have had, you know, and whether or not you might treat them differently in terms of any extra support. This might be how you want to handle things at interview, and maybe you don't want to do this, you know. So it is enabling us to have dialogue with, you know, across sectors, across industries, across the country with all sorts of different employers, which is most definitely a good thing. But when the labour shortages stop, let's hope that they stay being so open-minded.
Exactly. And of course, in some circumstances, actually people want women with experience of the justice system, and particularly in the third sector. You know, it's a real asset, certainly to for people like me who run organizations like mine and yours and many others, to actually have someone with that experience really enhances the work that you do.
Absolutely, yeah. And so working with charities for us is, you know, a completely different ball game. They completely get it. They're incredibly keen to increase the proportion of lived experience staff, you know. And the same thing goes for us at Working Chance as an employer. So some of our staff are absolutely have convictions, and some have, in fact, been clients of ours and gone through our service. You know, I think one of the real positives that we can take from this is that the more employers are actually giving opportunities to, well, specifically women with convictions in Working Chance's case, the more of them will have good experiences, because all of the research and indeed our market research bore this out, is that when employers do employ people with convictions, overwhelmingly the experience is positive. You know, in our survey, 86% of those who'd done it said that the people had performed well. 90% of them said that the people with convictions had settled really well into the organisation, got on well with colleagues. You know, and there's a wealth of other research that bears this out. So the more people that do it, you know, they will, the vast majority of them will have a good experience. And then they can be employers like, you know, Greggs and Timpsons, who are able to sort of stand up at, within those sort of employer networks or in on the media and say, actually, this has worked really well for us in all sorts of ways. And we really recommend that other employers do the same thing.
And going back to your organisation as a whole, could you give me some sort of idea? Let's take a woman in prison, for example, and she's coming out or she's come out. Could you give the listener a bit of a picture of like how and when she might get in contact with you and what you do and what the process looks like?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So women hear about us a range of different ways, where, you know, we do prison radio ads, and all sorts of agencies within HMPPS and other charities working with these women will recommend our services for someone who's a woman with a conviction who's looking for a job. So they normally contact us through our website or through phoning us, and then we'll arrange a registration call where we talk to the woman about kind of what she's looking for, what her expectations are, how our service works, just to make sure that it's right for her. I mean, really the only criteria are that you have to be a woman or identify as a woman, and you have to have had a conviction at some point. We don't want to exclude anybody, although if someone is, you know, really still kind of addicted to Class A drugs and still struggling with that, or if they are actually in the middle of a mental health crisis, then it's not so much that we're not going to accept them, it's more that we're not the right service for them at that point, and we'll actively help them to find other agencies. But if we are what the woman wants, then she gets matched up with one of our employability coaches, who then sort of forms a trusting relationship with her to really understand what she's good at and what her strengths are. So we're very, very much focused on women's strengths rather than, you know, any kind of perceived deficit. And they're all trained as careers coaches, so they can kind of use sort of tools and techniques to actually help the woman to reflect for herself on where she wants to go. We'll help her with her CV, with interview skills, with kind of building confidence. And I think probably the intervention that the women value the most is helping them with disclosure at interviews, which is just such a complex area, isn't it? It's not about telling a woman, this is how you do it, this is what you're legally required to disclose and at what moment, and, you know, and this is how you might say it, because it's such an emotional minefield. Telling, you know, complete strangers something so personal that's often tied up with kind of feelings of deep shame. And then, you know, kind of sharing with them perhaps some of the context around that offending, which again is probably tied up with histories of trauma, childhood trauma or present trauma involving domestic abuse, or, you know, mental ill health, drugs, etc. So telling such personal stuff in an interview situation is something that most of us would never dream of or have to kind of contemplate doing.
No, and often the person on the receiving end, you have to be a certain sort of person to be able to hear appropriately and receive that type of information. That's so, and not to say true. Something insensitive.
That is so, so true, Edwina. And, you know, I have to say, when we've worked with corporate volunteers in the past to do practice interviews to give women more experience of what that would be like if they do need to and want to disclose in an interview, You know, sure, there have been kind of failures of empathy or even something that looks a bit like prurience. We're like, oh, my God, that's so awful. Tell me more, which are grossly inappropriate. But then the reaction that really throws me when I see it is when in these mock interviews, and these are experienced interviewers from big companies, they start crying in the middle of a woman's disclosure.
Okay.
And then it's sort of, you know, trying to explain to them that, yeah, we understand that the tears come from empathy and from a, you know, a good place, but that's not appropriate and it doesn't send the right signal to the woman. It stops them talking and they end up kind of having to console the interviewer. The point being that that's kind of one of the most important building blocks of our service, and is really something that women are looking for from us. And we also offer free psychotherapy for up to a year for once a week for any woman who needs it as well, which can be really life-changing for these women, most of whom can't afford private therapy. And you'll know just how much most of them do need that. So once they consider themselves to be work ready, and we do as well, then they're passed over to one of our employment advisors within the charity, who again, that's, you know, kind of a trusting relationship. They get to know the woman, and then they start to look at the employers that we have on our books and the sorts of vacancies we've got. If the woman wants to then just do her own job searching, you know, and she wants support on that, that's great. We'll help her with that. But if she would like to know what vacancies we might be able to kind of point her towards, then we'll do that. And we'll really, a bit like, again, like a recruitment consultant, we will kind of be the liaison point between the woman and the employer and kind of set everything up. And then once a woman is in a role, we support her and the employer for up to a year after that, because sustainability is key. It is not about ticking boxes, about getting women into any old job, as some, you know, kind of statutory agencies might have taken that approach in the past. It is about her thriving and flourishing in that role, building a career, and seeing herself differently, reaping all the rewards of that, of you know, kind of believing that she's worth something, that, you know, that she's valued and accomplished, and fulfilling herself.
How many women do you work with? I see from your website that it says that 90% of women go on to secure a job, which is phenomenal.
It is absolutely phenomenal. Yep. And I think that that is a real testament to that work that we do with them before we start the job seeking bit. So the stuff that's more about kind of emotional and psychological readiness, and also making sure that she's at a place in her life where she can really commit to this as well. So helping with that, you know, stuff around kind of debt and housing, domestic violence, worries about children, helping with her with all that stuff so that she's got the best chance of getting the right job and flourishing in it. So, yeah, so our success rate is really high. Yeah, round about 90% of women will secure a job.
And then how many women a year, roughly, do you work with?
Yeah, roughly about 100 women a year. But I would say that we support many more women than that, because that's only the women that we've placed into roles. So many women in our service will find their own jobs. Some of them will decide that actually, when they're, you know, they've gone through psychotherapy, they've been, you know, doing the careers coaching, talking about what they want from life, and they might decide that actually that isn't what they want, you know, and that's absolutely fine. Maybe they just want to concentrate on being a mum, on building relationships, on kind of working on themselves. You know, there's no compulsion that they have to see it through to the end and get into a job, because it's the service that is designed around what they want and what flourishing and thriving and sort of resetting their lives looks like for them.
Yeah, and it's so amazing that you do that, because I was thinking, you know, the amount of friends of mine who have, you know, been career people, had babies, and then you have your children, everything changes, and then it changes again when your children grow up, and every stage your child gets to, everything changes again. And actually to have someone there to give you career advice and to bounce things off is so sort of vital, you know. I've been lucky enough to have a little, I sort it out for myself just to sort of help with who I am, where am I going, what's the point of me? You know, all those big questions that we all ask ourselves. So it's amazing that this is available to those women who really need it.
And for the majority of them, it's something that they haven't had before. And when we look at sort of evaluation from women of our service, you know, the stats are all good, but then if you actually look at the old-fashioned kind of evaluation, which is feedback, what do the women actually say? And the quotes are just lovely. And they are things like, you know, they will always kind of single out the particular colleague that they worked with and say, you know, Alex or whoever it is, you know, was amazing and she really helped me believe in herself and she really seemed to like me and that changed my perception of myself and finally I think I'm worth something, you know, I do deserve to do well in life. So it's that's the typical kind of feedback, is that mindset changes about their worth fundamentally.
So another area of your work is policy and research. So could you explain a little bit about what you do there?
Yeah, absolutely. A working chance, we don't think that policy work is an add-on. It's not a kind of a poor cousin to the service work. We think it's our kind of ethical duty, both to help individual women, but also to challenge and seek to change institutional injustice and system failure, because this is what we are hearing from women. This is, you know, underlies the criminalisation of so many women is that systems have failed them, that there's been discrimination, that there's been poverty, that there's been trauma, and those things have not been responded to in a helpful way. And in fact, you know, that we are actually criminalising poverty and trauma, I think, so often in this country. So, as I say, we think it's absolutely crucial that we're using what we learn from women and that we are working alongside those women who want to use their voices and their experiences in that way to influence policymakers, to talk to civil servants, to talk to ministers, to talk to people in HMPPS about what we're learning and about how things could be better. So that's an incredibly important part of what we do.
How many staff do you have? Just want to get an idea of how big, small you are.
So there's about 20 of us. I think we're recruiting at the moment. But so about 20. We are a really, really small charity. We are just under £1 million in terms of our annual income. So, yeah, by any judgment, we're a small charity. But we're one of those charities that people always say, you know, they punch above their weight. So our coverage is kind of UK-wide in terms of where the women come from, where the employers come from. As we've already said, our success rate, you know, we've got a great model. What we do really works in terms of getting those employment, those life-changing employment outcomes.
So what are your needs as an organisation? If you were to look to the sort of short, medium, even long term, if you want, but you never know sort of who's listening, and wondered if there were any sort of asks you might have.
So, you know, like every other charity, sustainable funding is the holy grail for us, because we need to be able to plan our service. We need to be able to grow. We can reach, you know, we could help so many more women. So we want increased awareness of our service among women who could benefit from it, and among all the agencies and charities and organisations working with those women. Please refer them to us. We have capacity to be helping many more women right now. In terms of funding, most of our money, but again, like most charities, comes from grant making trusts. But, you know, we'd love to hear from more funders who are interested in investing in what we do, because it works.
Yeah. Well, we'll make sure that all your details are in the footnotes of the podcast. But obviously, if anyone wants to get hold of you, they can Google the name Working Chance and probably find you easily that way. And hopefully this podcast will go a small way to amplifying your work as well. So thank you so much for taking me through the work of your organisation, and good luck with it.
Links relevant to this episode can be found in the pod notes below. If you enjoyed listening, we would love it if you would subscribe. Also, rate, review, and best of all, share this episode. Justice is produced for One Small Thing by the London Podcast Company.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.